Michael Tonsmeyer joins me this week to discuss his new craft brewery, Sapwood Cellars. This is Beersmith Podcast number 191.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 191, and it's late April 2019. Michael Tonsmeyer joins you this week to discuss his experience opening a small craft brewery. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for home brewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith and get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the Riptide Pump from Blickman Engineering. Designed for home brewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, removable tri-clamp stainless steel head that's easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. It has the integral Blickman linear valve for precise flow control. Get the Riptide Pump today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available for download, and also the mobile version's out. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider recipe support to the Beersmith platform, along with new integrated water profile and mash pH tools. There's dozens of new features, including cloud folders, updated databases, support for fruit juice and honey, as well as new Whirlpool hop options. Download your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com and give it a try. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Michael Tonsmeyer. Michael is the author of the book Sour Beers, author of the blog called The Mad Fermentationist, and is also a partner in a new brewery called Sapwood Cellars. Michael, it's as always, it's great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, it's great to be back on the familiar Skype channel rather than actually having to sit down with you and have a beer like we were down in Nashville a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, that is tough, having a beer together, right?
Of course,
you're probably still only a few miles away. We've been through this before, right? You live like in what, Maryland or Northern Virginia, and I live in Northern Virginia.
Exactly. Yeah. So I live just barely on the DC line, but very close to Maryland, and that's where the brewery is. So my commute's not too bad.
Well, and that's obviously what we came to talk about today. You recently opened Sapwood Cellars. I understand you opened it. Is it last fall? Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. We started brewing last August, and tap room opened end of September.
And it's located in Maryland, too far from the Beltway, I think, right?
Yeah, well, it's up a little bit. Columbia, Maryland, we're sort of between 95 and 27, just a little bit west of Baltimore, north of D.C.
Awesome. And can you give us a quick overview? What's the size of the brewery?
Sure. We originally the idea, my partner Scott Janish, who also runs a blog, and I were looking for spaces. We were on a little bit of a shoestring budget, and sort of the idea was we would follow the model that places like Rare Barrel and Refren Blendery do, where they just buy wort from another production facility and they barrel age it or ferment it or put it on fruit. And we got really lucky. We found this fantastic space that had already been built out as a brewery. Regrettably for them, the previous brewery in the space didn't quite make it, but when we moved in, they already had a tap system in place. They had a bar, they had bathrooms, they had a pad to contain the brewing equipment. They had been planning on a 3-barrel system. We talked to some people, and 3 barrels is possible, but with a space that had a 3,000 square foot tasting room, 4,000 square feet for production. A little 3-barrel system would have meant probably brewing maybe 6 times a week, something like that. So we went with a 10-barrel system from ForgeWorks out of Colorado, a couple of 10-barrel tanks, a 15 and a 20, and we've been making a go at it. We brew once or twice a week, and so far it's been just the two of us. We're just starting to look for some production help, but
and that's you and your partner there on the script for those on YouTube there.
Yeah, right. I'm on the left. He's on the right. You can see from the fact that he's a vegan who goes to the gym on a regular basis. He was a lot more prepared for the physical rigors of brewing life compared to my 13 years in a cubicle.
Well, we'll get to talk about that shortly, I'm sure. So the brewery was mostly set up. I guess they had no equipment, though, or it was built out for equipment or something.
Yeah, so they just had this little system. We probably could have made an offer to the company that leased it from, but because we knew we had 7 or 8 months at least in front of us for federal licensing, state licensing, local liquor license, we decided to take that time and honestly the money we saved because we didn't have to do the rest of the build out. And so not only did we have to get the equipment and install it, but we also had to get a chiller for the glycol to keep the tanks at the correct fermentation temperature. We needed a bigger water supply line. We needed electricity run for the pumps, and sort of a lot of other little things like that, a new dishwasher. And so we sort of had to do a lot of that infrastructure upgrade. Luckily, we got a little bit of money from the landlord, a little bit of free rent, and that sort of carried us through.
So how long, when did you actually start the project? I know we've talked about it before on the podcast. It was some time ago, right?
Yeah, so it was about March 2017. We found the location, but we didn't close the lease until December 2017. The old landlord was selling, and they didn't want to sort of sign a long-term lease with the new tenant. They wanted to, you know, wait and let the new landlord take care of that. And so if we'd had a little bit more guts, we probably would have ordered the equipment before that final lease was signed. But if the lease had fallen through for whatever reason, we didn't want to have, 7 or 8, 10, 20 barrel vessels, 15 feet tall, showing up at one of our backyards with no place to store it. And so it really took, at that point, 7 or 8 months until we started brewing, and then a month and a half or so after that, we finally got open.
So you opened the brewery. Well, you signed the lease in December of 2017, and then when did you actually open?
Yeah, so it was September 2018. We were open for business. So less than a year is pretty quick, all things considered.
Probably helped that you had a lot of the bathrooms and tasting room and all the other facilities built out, right? You didn't have to.
It was a little bit tricky. We picked up some of their permits midway through and just thought it would be easy to get them signed off and completed. And we found a couple of issues. We got a last minute zoning thing jumped on us that meant we had to have a traffic study done and parking analysis and. That's sort of probably tip number one for opening a brewery, and I'm sure you've heard this before, but everything's going to take longer than you think it will. Things will take more money. There'll be surprises along the way, and just be prepared to not try to budget out your last dollar 6 months out from opening.
Yeah, I would imagine. Well, I want to get into the business ends of things in a minute, but let's talk about beer first. How did you pick a lineup of beers to start with?
Yeah, so I coming from a home brewing background and from a consulting background, we had a lot of ideas. There were a lot of beers that we were passionate about drinking. Generally, we try to stick to moderate alcohol. That was sort of the idea starting out. We started with a hoppy wheat beer with Amarillo. We started with a Citra heavy pale ale. We started with an IPA, and particularly sort of focusing on the New England hazy, a little less bitterness. A little bit more hop flavor and aroma. We started with a hoppy rye beer. And I'm trying to think what else was in the opening lineup. Oh, and we had, obviously, with American sour beers, I'm known for sour beers. I'm not the world's biggest fan of kettle sours. I'm not going to say we'll never do one. But I really want to make a difference. Maryland doesn't have a lot of breweries that do a lot of sour beers. And so we wanted to open with a Saison that had Brettanomyces and a little bit of lactobacillus, something that was a little bit distinct and particularly distinct from the lactose, vanilla, fruit, kettle sour sort of juice bombs. That was sort of the opening lineup, and it's just sort of evolved from there.
So you didn't kettle sour it then, you just let it go, huh?
Yeah, exactly.
Regular traditional.
Yeah, we actually just brewed sort of another one today, and sort of the general approach that we've been doing is we have a 15-barrel tank. My friend Blaine is the brewer down at Sinistral Brewing in Manassas, and he had this extra tank in storage. It's got a manway at the top. It's a little bit more of a hassle to dry hop in. It's got a narrower valve at the bottom, so it's a little bit hard to do IPAs in. being 15 barrels, it's a little bit of a weird, awkward size for a 10 barrel system. So it'd be like, mm-hmm. you know, having a 15 gallon, but it's actually even bigger than that. It'd probably be like a 17 and a half gallon fermenter for a 10 gallon batch size.
Right.
But it works perfectly for us because what we'll do is we'll just pitch lactobacillus in our ale yeast. We'll let it sour for, a week or so until primary fermentation is done. All the alcohol is there. The pH is nice and low, you know, down the mid threes. And then we'll add fruit puree. So for the one we did today, we're still up in the air. It may be mango, it may be peach, but for 300 gallons of beer, about 450 pounds of fruit will go in. We probably will dry hop it, give it some interesting hoppy aromatics, and then go on from there. Mm-hmm. It's a lot easier than doing a kettle sour. You don't have to time anything. You don't have to use that heat to heat it up and then cool it down and then heat it up again to pasteurize and cool it down again. But there is that small risk that some of that lactic acid bacteria will get into your non-sour beers. But that's why we have a dedicated tank, we have dedicated fittings, but there's always a risk.
Yep. Well, so that was your initial lineup. How did things change once you actually started selling beer?
Yeah, so our sort of idea was that we wouldn't have that sort of classic four core beers, that we would... based on how the beers turned out and based on consumer reaction to them, we would change. And so I think we've already brewed somewhere on the order of 40 different beers. And there's been some, like that first pale ale was magical, Rings of Light. I put the whole recipe up on my blog. It's a relatively sort of simple recipe, pale malt, golden naked oats, chit malt, which is an undermodified German malt that's great for head retention. A whole bunch of Columbus and Cascade in the kettle, and then just dry hopped with Citra. It was spectacular. It was, for a 4.8% beer, rich and creamy and full and bright hoppiness. And so we've done that one two more times. And honestly, the second batch and the third batch were both very good. That first batch still has a very special place in my heart because of it, having that beer. Was one of the first beers we brewed, was really just this, like, this is going to work out, you know, that our skill set is going to be able to translate to the system, the constraints we have, you know, the water we have, all those things.
So is a pale ale your top selling beer then?
No, I'm sure it's the same for everybody. People love double IPA. It really doesn't matter. You get something with 8.5% alcohol, particularly something that has bright, fruity, tropical kind of flavors, people go crazy. We do a beer called Snip Snap that's a wheat note heavy IPA with dry hopped with Citra and Galaxy. The last batch we did lasted 2.5 days. So we had about 7 barrels in kegs, and it just, there was like a line of people with growlers nonstop for 2.5 days, and we sold it all in the tasting room. And it's the sort of beer that we were very happy to have. It really put us on the map. We certainly had a great initial rush of people who were excited, people who were aware of us, but that really put us on sort of the map of people on a local Facebook group that caters to beer traders and people who travel for good beer, and, you know, got us great scores on Untappd and all the other sort of beer rating websites.
So are you like most craft breweries now, you sell more than half IPAs or what?
Oh yeah. If you put together pale ale, IPA, double IPA, it's a pretty good chunk of our sales. But yeah, it's been fun. We do a series called Cheater Hops. That's our IPAs. And sort of the joke is that Scott and I have had this running gag that there are some hop varieties that are so terrific, like Citra, Mosaic, Simcoe. You don't have to be a good brewer to make a good IPA with them. You just add them and make a beer that tastes like Citra. And so every batch has a different hop combination. We've done Nelson and Mosaic. We've done with the one we're working on now is Citra, Simcoe, Mosaic. So it's just sort of us using our favorite hop varieties. And that one always seems to get people excited. And it gives us a place to keep honestly acting like homebrewers and trying out new combinations and finding out what works and what doesn't work.
And what are the best hopping combinations that work for you? Are you doing a lot of whirlpool hops, excessive dry hops, those kinds of things?
Yeah, it's interesting. We've talked to a lot of other commercial brewers in the area, and they're always, rather than being shocked by our dry hopping. It's our kettle additions. And they're not really crazy. We do, most of our beers get 22 pounds of hops in the kettle for 10 barrels. So it's on the order of, I'm trying to remember what the conversion is. I think it's about 5 ounces in a 10 gallon batch, something like that.
Is that what does that give you in IBUs, or is that you when you say in the kettle, you mean Whirlpool, or you mean
mostly in the Whirlpool? Beersmith, we have Beersmith 3 and it's got the things. I have to admit, Brad, the IBUs it gives seem very high compared to the way the beer tastes. I think our pale ale says it's 100 and something IBUs. We have started pre-chilling. And oddly, even when we pre-chilled to like 170 for the Whirlpool, we seem to get almost as many IBUs, and it has me totally baffled. Because
I don't know. I would think 170. Yeah, 170, you'd get a much lower utilization typically.
Yeah, and maybe it's just that we're leaving them in because on a commercial scale, rather than sort of the Whirlpool just lasting for 5 or 10 minutes, we Whirlpool for 15 minutes with the pump on, then we let settle for 15 minutes. And then we're running through the heat exchanger. And so there's still hot wort sitting in the kettle with the hops, probably an hour and 15 minutes after we turn the flame out and add the hops. So it may just be that the period is so long that we're achieving higher utilization.
Certainly possible, yeah.
Yeah, and so these are the kinds of things that have been the hardest jump from home brewer to commercial brewer, is just wrapping our heads around the differences in the physics, the thermodynamics, because it's just a different way of adding hops. I, as a home brewer, when we were sort of getting these recipes right, I was trying my best to sort of simulate this by, rather than turning the burner all the way off at flame out, I would turn it down as low as I could just to try to hold the wort at 205 degrees or something like that for an hour to try to get the same sort of character. And there's all these, so Scott is, he's writing a book right now on hops and particularly the science behind hopping. It's amazing how far IBUs go down after the initial sort of reading that you might get in the fermenter. Dry hopping can reduce IBUs, fermentation drops out IBUs. And so I think that's part of it too, is that we may be starting with a very high amount of IBUs, but then it's being pulled down by the dry hopping rates we're doing and by maybe particularly the yeast that we're using that's very flocculent.
So are you selling primarily out of the tap room right now, or are you packaging a lot?
Yeah, no, we're doing our first canning run. I don't know if this is going to be airing this week or next, but the Sunday, the 28th or whatever next Sunday is our first can release. Up until now, it's been exclusively draft growlers. Probably 95% in the tasting room.
So, mostly in the tasting room. A few people taking it home then.
Yeah, and we'll send a few kegs around. If a bar is particularly excited to have us and wants to do a little tap takeover, we'll send 3 or 4 kegs, and one of us will show up and meet people. But we really don't look at those as big money makers for us. It's almost more of revenue neutral advertising that you're hopefully getting to talk to people who like to go out to drink beer within, a 15 or 20 mile radius of the brewery. They might not be aware of us if they're not, reading our blogs or listening to wonderful brewing podcasts. And so just getting the name out there, because there are so many breweries now and there's so many places making fantastic beer. It's hard to stand out. And it's hard to stand out compared to going to a beer bar where you can get 40 taps of great beer from around the world. You really have to give someone something special to get them to come to you, particularly in our case, in a little office park. And, we don't have any cool restaurants next door. We don't have a music venue. People who are coming to us really have to be excited about the beer, or it has to be really convenient for them.
Now, I know you do a lot of barrel aging, at least at home. Have you started doing any of that? Any specialty, really exotic beers in the brewery?
Oh, yeah. We got a lot of weird stuff aging. I've got a spreadsheet. I think we're up to 36 barrels now, and a lot of fun stuff. We just got a local liquor store did a single barrel Four Roses bourbon selection. And as part of that, they bought sort of all the bourbon that was in the barrel. And as a sort of a free sweetener, the distillery gives them the barrel for sort of promotion. But they pre-sold all of the bourbon, and so they gave it to us. And so they're right around the corner from us, All View Liquors, and they called it the bourbon was named Undisputed. And so we're making some sort of play on that, and we put our 9% Imperial Stout into it, boom roasted. And so that's the only non-sour barrel we have going. The rest of them are wine barrels.
All sour, yeah, right?
Exactly. So we've got wine barrels, we've got brandy barrels, rum barrels, bourbon barrels.
Have you released a lot of them yet or not?
We haven't released anything. Okay. We just got in 9,000 half-liter glass bottles. We got our blending tank, and I believe later this week the actual bottler is showing up. So we're hoping within the next month, maybe we'll be able to get the first batch into bottles, and then maybe a month or two after that, it'll be bottle conditioned and ready to go.
Nice. Well, I want to switch and go into a little bit of the business end of things. Many of the craft brewers that I know said most of their time's actually spent on business. Although I know you were brewing a beer today, I think, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
But what are some of the business tips you picked up? Obviously you decided to focus on direct sales, which higher profit margin, right?
Sure. No, I think sort of the first decision we made that really sort of helped us was we started clubs. And so in August we released one that was like a sort of a mug club that you could pay a little bit up front and you would get discounts on any draft beer or growler fills you got. Mm-hmm. And we also gave people a special growler. And we do these sort of every Thursday, we try to do a flavored beer. So last week we took a wheat beer and we had freeze dried strawberries and fresh basil. The week before that, we took the stout and we added a bunch of herbs and spices meant to make it taste like root beer. And everyone can come in and try it by the glass. But if you want to take it home, you have to be in the club. And so it gave them sort of this exclusive access and also gives them ability to reserve cans when we do cans.
Gives folks a reason to come back, right?
Exactly. And gave us a little bit of a cash infusion early on. For the Sour Club, we did an exclusive, we'll do some special beers just for the club members, but they also get, I think we said two bottles of each of our first six or seven releases, plus a couple exclusives. And we had decanter baskets made. I was just up in Delaware picking these things up. So a bottle will go in there and allow you to sort of pour out of it. Then there was sort of a founders club that included both and plus some extra sweeteners. And that went really well. I mean, we sold a lot of those. I think we've sold a total of 250 something club members. And at, you know, a couple $100 each, that money really went a long way to giving us, some financial padding when things took longer than expected, allowed us to buy things when we might have had to rent things, allowed us to start filling barrels, early on when we might have been pinching pennies, and not, you know, not had a little extra money to brew another beer, buy barrels, buy racks, early on. And if we hadn't started early on, we'd be that much further behind now on getting those beers out. Mm-hmm. And so like that was like this great little start, and it started to get sort of excitement. That was a way for sort of, both friends, but also just people who were really excited about us to sort of, buy in a little. And then that really helped, you know, they became our best advocates. A lot of them are in there every week. And even if somebody gets more than, you know, if they were given a dollar off a pour, and even if somebody comes in twice a week and has three pours each time, sure, they're getting more than their $200 back over the course of the year, but we're still making money off of all those beers that they're getting at a, you know, five or six.
Oh, sure. Yeah, sure. Yeah. One of the things I want to ask you about, how do the taproom sales compare with selling through other channels? Obviously, good margin on taproom, right?
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's sort of add-ons, because when you have a tap room, you're also running the air conditioning and you're paying bartenders and you're, you know, dealing with all those other things, but tap rooms make so much of what we do make sense. When you sell, and again, I've heard that some brewers sell their kegs for considerably more than we do, but like an average beer, IPA, double IPA, we're in the sort of $200 for a half barrel keg. Mm-hmm. And that sounds like real money, but a lot of our beers, you know, with 3 or 4 pounds per barrel of dry hopping, we're buying our hops on the spot market. I mean, something like Galaxy costs $30 or $35 a pound. That adds up pretty quick. And not to mention overhead and all those things. We would not be able to do the beers that we do if we were selling only making $75 or $80 a keg. When you sell a 14-ounce pour for $7 or $8, there's a lot of money there.
Yeah.
The trick is that you have to attract people. You have to get people to come to you. And for us, where we're in a place that doesn't have a lot of foot traffic, a lot of that is it takes some effort and it takes some time. And the first couple months were pretty slow. And you know, we still have slow weekends. And there's very little way for us to predict, you know. Like this weekend, Thursday was solid. Friday, Good Friday was terrific. Saturday was okay. And Sunday being Easter Sunday, I guess people didn't want to go out for beer, was probably our worst day of the year. and we're still sort of learning, you know, what days work and what days don't, or, you know, what are the, you know, what causes a day to be good, or what are people really looking for, or how you turn someone in from a stop by once into a regular customer. It's, you know, salesmanship, and we're spectacularly lucky to have, we were actually forced to hire a county resident. We couldn't get a liquor license without having a full-time manager or an investor be a Howard County resident where we are. And we got this guy, Spencer, who had run a local sports bar for a number of years, but is a home brewer and an amazingly hard worker, and has really taken running the tasting room and dealing with employees and scheduling food trucks and making, you know, paying out the cash tips and all that. He's taken that, but then he's also helps us with design work and with ideas for beers. It's been, I don't know what we would have done without him. Mm.
And obviously selling in the tap room, you have advantages in terms of freshness, especially when you talk about something like IPAs, right?
Yeah, no, it's. I think people, I think a lot of homebrewers for a long time have known what a fresh hoppy beer tastes like compared to something you get in the supermarket that's maybe sat warm for a month or two and was filtered and all that.
And you probably don't have to deal with things like hop creep and all these other problems that come in when you start packaging and trying to keep it fresh.
Yeah, and it, for us, it was a very easy way to start because it's sort of like having training wheels that we didn't have to worry about packaging early on. We could focus on flavors. It also allows us to pull beers after they're on their downhill. You know, sometimes because we have to brew, say, 3 weeks out for the replacement beer. And if the new beer's ready and we still have a keg or two of that old beer left, if it's still good and we have a spot for it, we'll leave it on. But often after a weekend, we'll let them overlap and then we'll sort of quietly retire it. It's just not worth pouring a bad beer for someone or a beer that isn't spectacular. Because you're getting somebody in the door once, and if they don't have a great time and they don't love the beer, they may not come back. And that for us has been a big thing, is that you're always better dumping a beer that is okay if you have something great to replace it, rather than trying to eke every dime. You end up sort of nickel and diming yourself.
And one of the things I've always found interesting about craft brewing is if you're successful out of the tap room, you potentially have to grow into much smaller margins. So it can become a limit to growth. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, we had a local brewer joke with us that they're brewing, you know, three times as much beer as they were 2 years ago, but they're certainly not making three times as much money. I think sort of the model we're looking at, I consulted for Modern Times for a number of years, yeah. And they have, so they've been open for 5 years. They've got 5 locations with 2 more opening. And so they started in San Diego. They opened up 2 more tasting rooms. They opened one in LA. They opened a new little brewery in Portland. They're opening a new thing in Anaheim. And they send beer to Maryland now. I mean, they are doing some of that lower margin stuff, but they, as much as they can, are growing their physical presence too, so that they can have more control over the beer. They can have sort of a flagship experience so that you can go in and if you love going to the restaurant, maybe you're more likely to pick up a 6-pack at the supermarket next time you see it because you've had that beer fresh, because they have employees in that market that can keep an eye on the accounts and, you know, can intervene if something is, you know, sitting around too long.
So your growth model would be to open another location nearby or something like that, rather than try and, you know, go into this lower margin bottling and wholesale distribution and all those things.
Exactly. I think phase sort of, we'll call it phase two, would be open up. So currently we're paying about $10 a square foot, which is terrifically reasonable when you're having to pay for 4,000 square feet of production space. It really doesn't matter where the production space is, as long as people are getting fresh beer in the tasting room. It's obviously easiest if you're producing the beer 5 feet away from where you're serving it. Mm-hmm. But I think next we'll probably go for a higher value square footage, but with a little bit more foot traffic. You know, somewhere that has some cool restaurants, has some apartment buildings, is a little bit more walkable. I'd love a little outdoor space if we could swing it. And, you know, maybe do a little food component. Currently, we're just doing food trucks that come. We're working on a very limited food license. Mm-hmm. And then sort of the pie in the sky long term would be then to open up sort of the bigger production focused facility and maybe turn what we have now into sours only or something like that.
Well, that brings me to marketing, which is critically important. How do you get people into the tap room, since that's where most of your sales take place?
Yeah, I mean, so many people that I've talked to sort of assume that the fact that, I mean, I've run a blog for 12 years and Scott has a blog and I've wrote a book and he's working on a book, and very few of the people who come in really have any idea who we are. It is wonderful that once a week I'm out in the tasting room talking to somebody. And
but you're a celebrity though, Michael.
I'm wide and thin, and the sort of people who are my fans will stop in and shake my hand and say, "Hey, we detoured on recently our drive from Quebec to Florida because we had to try your beer, and wow, is it so good, and it's so great to meet you, and could you sign my book?" And but those people are a very small slice. Most of our customers work in the offices, in the office park, or, you know, drop their daughter off at daycare at the next unit down, or love biking and this is on their bike path home, or whatever it is. Like, they are just like people who like beer. And that's who we're trying to grab. For us, it really, like, pouring at festivals was amazingly helpful. I've had a lot of fun with YouTube. I did a YouTube video where I brewed our double IPA Snip Snap, same recipe, exact same ingredients from the same bags, on the home brewing system that I used to use and on the commercial system. And because we did it at the brewery, it was all sort of legal beer, and we paid the taxes on it, and we served them blind to people in the tasting room and got people sort of unvarnished feedback. But just doing, like, fun, wacky things, I think less than sort of a polished, high-quality, artisanal video, people are more excited by sort of a little clickbaity, you know, is beer brewed on a $150,000 system better than on a $1,500 system?
So what'd you find out? Was it better on the $150,000 system?
Sadly, it was a little better. Oh, although, well. honestly, I think the biggest issue was that on the big system, we went to the bright tank and we let it settle and then we transferred it. And on the little system, we just sort of went to a keg directly from the fermenter 2 days before we tapped it, and it still had a little of that green hop bite kind of thing. I think if they'd both been given maybe another week to fully carbonate and settle, the homebrewed version would have been 95% the same. And not to say better or worse, just it was a little bit different, because I replicated the same hop timing, so the big beer, the big batch, got that long whirlpool time. It got more bitterness, where the homebrew scale batch, you know, just sort of naturally cools. And even if you add the hops at flame out, it was down to, you know, loses about a degree a minute in my case. And so it really just didn't get nearly as much bitterness.
What are the, some of the critical marketing sales lessons you've learned so far?
Man, it really is, like, it's a hard one to do, but, like, make a beer that people get really excited about. Making that first batch of Snip Snap, sales were slow. We released that beer, and it was like lighting something on fire. It was all of a sudden, 200 people in the tasting room, you know, where maybe there used to be 50, that kind of thing. And I look at it sort of like the same way car manufacturers do a special car for a car show. They're not really trying to sell a whole lot of the $300,000 new technology, crazy design car. They're trying to get their name out there. They're trying to get consumer recognition that they are doing interesting things. That got a lot of people in the door the first time. They had a great time. They enjoyed the beers, and now they've been back again. And so figuring out how to get people in the door the first time, we've tried a whole bunch of things. One idea was to go around the neighborhood and hand out little flyers that said, you know, good for a free half pour. And I think we handed out 100 of those, and maybe one or two of them came back. So, I mean, despite trying to hand out free beer, it didn't go so well.
Who would have thought?
Yeah. And, you know, who knows, but really making sure people taste the beer. So doing, whether it's festivals or, tap takeovers, I social media, certainly I think is a big part of it. Instagram in particular is really important for beer right now, because it's all about photos. It's all about, you know, beer that looks cool. It's in a fun glass. We use a lot of real ingredients. I don't have anything inherently against natural flavors and extracts and those sorts of things. But I think generally real ingredients make better beer, and they also look a lot cooler in a photo. You know, when you've got that picture with the actual fruit or with the actual vanilla beans or whatever, you know, you get cool color in the beer, you get, you know, it's a more interesting story. It says you're more artisanal, and all sort of translates better a little bit to social media rather than somebody with an eyedropper with, you know, red 7 and, vanillin, derived from wood pulp or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, in addition to making all these, brewing, production, marketing decisions, you also have to hire and manage people, right?
Yeah, no, I was mentioning, and luckily so far, Spencer has taken sort of the brunt of that. We really had that sort of hard decision because we had to have someone from the county. And so far it hasn't been too tough. You know, we try to sit down once a month and talk with him because he's in the tasting room 100% of the time we're open. Try to get, you know, feedback on what beers are selling well, what the reaction to different beers are, what sorts of beers we want to brew the next month. But he really deals with most of the day-to-day with our bartenders. And the bartenders themselves have been fantastic. A great mix of people one of our bartenders just left. He was a PhD physical therapist, and they got offered a promotion and so couldn't keep working part-time here. But we've got people who are home brewers. We've got people who are sort of full-time bartenders, splitting time between us and other tap rooms, other breweries. And so they've all been pretty professional. And Spencer every once in a while has to, pull somebody aside and talk to somebody if he sees a problem. I mean, it's like any job. It's easy to, have, you know, slip ups and, you know, we're very, firm on bartenders not drinking on the job. You know, they certainly come in and they can have a couple of sips of any new beers to talk about them, but, you know, we don't want to be a brewery where all the bartenders are partying when they should be making sure somebody doesn't, you know, needs a refill, or that, you know, even just talking to somebody and figuring out why they're in there, what beers are interesting to them and those sorts of things. We're just now starting to talk about hiring someone to at least part-time help clean tanks and kegs. And so that'll be sort of the next adventure, because with sour beers ready to bottle and with, additional things coming up, the two of us really just can't spend as many hours as we currently are cleaning and doing sort of the basic tasks of brewery running.
Mm. How'd you go about funding the brewery?
It's all, other than sort of, you know, the club sales and whatever, it's all between the two of us and our parents.
Wow.
So we were lucky in the sense that, we got that space. And so we started this whole thing for, not much money. I mean, somewhere in the, I can't remember what the total was, $275,000, $300,000, something like that, which is way lower than most breweries start for.
Yeah. What were some of the surprises you ran into when you went to open the brewery? You mentioned quite a few of those.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously, like I've mentioned before, you know, sort of surprise zoning things are always fun. I think for me, it was really how hot it gets in a brewery in August when you're used to sitting in an air-conditioned desk. We do have an air conditioning unit in the back of the brewery, but it is not probably powerful enough to handle You know, 95 degrees outside and, 320 gallons of boiling wort. I was sweating a lot. I was having to go lie down in the tasting room after, 4 or 5 hours of running around. And I was very lucky to have Scott. And we've really now come up with sort of a much better system where we'll break up the day. So for example, today I came in at 8 a.m. I started collecting the hot water. We don't have an always on, hot liquor tank that's just filled with 180 degree water. We have an on-demand hot water heater that you set to whatever temperature you want and it collects. And so for about 4 hours, I mashed in, I started the runoff, and Scott got in around noon. And then a few hours later, I could move on to something else, and he finished up cleaning and pitching the yeast and all that. And so it sort of breaks the day into a lot more like a nicer chunk than solo brewing and trying to do that by yourself from 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., which is about what our days are, and allows both of us to have a little bit of time to focus on something else, whether it's writing on the brewery's blog or whether it's working on our own blogs or researching or buying something. I mean, we're still trying to, that's part of our issue with always having different beers, is that we always are trying to source new ingredients and come up with new ideas for the variant, the flavored beer every Thursday. It's just how much there is to do. I'll admit that I think we both thought that somehow we would be able to hold on to our day jobs and open the brewery. I have no idea how anyone does that.
That didn't work though, right? I mean, you're full time now.
Oh yeah. No, it, we didn't even make it to brewing. I mean, there was just so much to do between, when we were getting started. I think the only way we could have done it was to hire a full-time brewer at the start. And honestly, that would have made a lot of financial sense. I could have paid an experienced brewer, considerably less than I was making as a government employee. But when I've wanted to work at a brewery since, 14 years ago or 13 years ago now, and I'm finally opening a brewery, it seems so silly to pay someone else to do my dream job. And one of the things I really learned from consulting was that, as much as you can give an idea or you can tell people something, the people who are there when the decision's actually made, when the action is done, have the biggest influence over it. You have to be there for example, today we have, we did a new IPA that we released last week with Sabro hops, which have this vanilla coconut mint flavor. Mm. It was just a weird fun hop. We wanted to give it a try. We paired it with real low bitterness, sweet beer, and we're doing a cocoa nib version of it. So we're going to do a chocolate IPA with these hops. But tasting it today, it had a sort of a weird flavor. And so we went back and forth on whether we should use something else, whether we should scrap this idea. You have to be there to make that decision. If I wasn't there today because I was at work on a Monday, the brewer, whoever else was there, would have had to make that decision and would really be guiding the beer more than I might have with that initial idea. Or they would have just said whatever and gone ahead with it and not done that tasting and evaluation and whatever that we did.
Well, along those lines, what are some of the differences that come into play when you're brewing 10 barrels at a time instead of 10 gallons at a time?
Sure. Honestly, at this scale, things are pretty similar. There's definitely the how-to process is different. Just sort of the
how to carry up several hundred pounds of grain, right?
Exactly. I mean, that's a pretty good one. One of the biggest differences is how long it takes to mash in. At home, you have all your crushed grain, you have your water, and generally, you just dump the grain in and stir, and maybe you dump it in two or three sort of, batches and stir, but sort of all the grain from the time you start adding to the water to the time it's all in is probably no more than 4 or 5 minutes.
Yeah.
At this scale, I'm sending water in, I'm sending grain in, and at this point we don't have a mill and an auger, so essentially we're just buying sacks of pre-crushed grain. For a double IPA, it can be 1,000 pounds of grain. And it just takes it physically.
That's more than one sack, I think, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of sacks. It's like 20 sacks. Right? And that amount of time that it might take 15 or 20 minutes by the time all the water is in, all the grain's in, and if you're adding the grain, say, too slowly, and you get all the water in, the mash temperature for the first 15 minutes could be 165 degrees, and then you add the rest of the grain finally, and it might bring the temperature down to 155. But when you have that much, and now malts have so much enzyme, and you know, 15 or 20 minutes at 165 could kill a lot of the beta amylase, and you're going to end up with a lot lower attenuation. And that's something we struggled with the first few batches, was beers didn't quite dry out, you know, as much as we would have expected from our test batches, from our experience. And part of that turned out that one of our thermometers was a little wonky. And part of that, too, was that, like, we just weren't matching the rate of grain going in to the amount of water going in. If you had a bigger...
If you don't keep that balance, the pH goes crazy, right?
Exactly. And yeah. so we also, with the salts, will add, you know, I'll essentially add in 3 or 4 sacks, a chunk of the salts, keep it going. We now have flow meters, so we can kind of monitor how quickly the water is going in. But a lot of the measurements are a little more wonky. With our flow meters, there's sort of a little bit of an error rate, you know, 2 or 3%, but that can throw off the amount of water you need, or the wort you collect, or the mash temperature you hit, because you don't have exactly as much water as you're thinking. And so just figuring out how to measure things that took some time. Just sort of the thermodynamics of it. I used pumps at home, but when you're dealing with several feet of height difference, you can really do a lot of transferring before you even turn the pump on, just letting gravity, you know, from the mash tun go into the kettle. Even if they're at the same height, the kettle's starting at much lower volume than the mash tun, and they'll sort of even out, and then you can use the pump to sort of assist on the way. Mm-hmm. And so just little tips like that. I'd been a consultant for breweries, but it's very different when you're day-to-day pulling those levers, figuring out not only the best way to do something, but just the most practical way to do something. You really want to, you know, use the least amount of effort that gets the best results. And I'm all for doing more work if it means better beer, but there's no point in wasting time or energy if there's no advantage to it.
We're coming up near the end here, but what advice do you have for somebody who's looking to open their own craft brewery?
I mean, it's the sort of the same kind of things you'd say to someone who is looking to start homebrewing. Talk to other people who you respect that do it. I sent a lot of emails early on, and I talked to, luckily I had contacts from writing the book or writing Brew Your Own articles, reached out, and, you know, and people said, you know, I think we had originally said we were thinking about maybe a 5 or 7 barrel system after we decided we were buying, and brewers came back and just said, you know, you're crazy to do anything less than 10 barrels. And we took that to heart, particularly because, just like homebrewing, if you get a little bigger system, 50% bigger doesn't cost 50% more.
No.
There's always certain thresholds. So we have a direct fire kettle. We don't have a steam kettle. You go over 10 barrels, you really need steam heat so you don't get excess darkening. And that would have added a lot more money. So 10 barrels sort of made sense for us. Really think about, it's important to be passionate about the beers you produce, but you also have to be realistic on what people are excited to buy. As much as I love Saison and I think it's exciting, Saison is not nearly as sexy as it was 4 or 5 years ago. You call a beer a Saison, a lot of people just don't want it because they've had some bad Saison, some poorly fermented Saison, some, you know, hot boozy Saisons, and it's not what people are looking for right now. And so we'll do them occasionally and people seem to like them, but it just, the hoppy stuff is right now what sells and what gets people coming in. And you just sort of have to realize it's a business and you can take little pieces of it and kind of keep that passion, that hobby, but it all has to be in service to the fact that if you don't sell beer, you go out of business.
Well, we're at the end here, but I wanted to give you one last chance to mention where your brewery is located for folks that want to try and visit, and maybe also your website.
Sure. The brewery's in Columbia, Maryland, we're open Thursday through Sunday currently. We might be adding some more hours later. I still occasionally write on madfermentationist.com. I'm actually working on an article right now on a brewer's emergency kit, sort of all the things that we've kept on hand, if an enzyme or some sugar or backup gaskets and things that I'm trying to use sort of my homebrew instincts as a professional brewer and write things that maybe professional brewers haven't heard and give homebrewers sort of an insight into that sort of craft brewing world. And also, just to tack on one thing, I'm going to be doing a pre-conference seminar thing on sour beers for HomebrewCon this year. So if you're going there and you want to spend 3 hours with me, listen to sour beers. It's like a tack on, add on thing with your ticket, but should be exciting.
I'm looking forward to it as well. Looking forward to being there. Real quick, your website for your brewery as well.
Oh yeah, it's sapwoodcellars.com, and we try to do like a monthly post somewhere, kind of walking that line between homebrew nerdery and come buy our beers because we're cool.
Well, thank you, Michael. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Yeah, thanks as always for having me, Brad. It's always fun to sort of take a step back and think about all these things.
And again, my guest today was Michael Tonsmeyer. He's author of the book Sour Beers. You can visit his brewery called Sapwood Cellars in Columbia, Maryland. And I think it's sapwoodcellars.com, right?
Yeah, we took the obvious one.
Okay. Well, thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Brad.
Well, a big thank you to Michael Tonsmeyer for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off the all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith and get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also Blickman Engineering, creators of the Riptide Pump. Designed for homebrewers, this pump features a whisper quiet sealed housing, a removable tri-clamp stainless steel head that's easy to clean, and a built-in relief valve for easy priming. Get the Riptide Pump today, another great innovation from BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, Beersmith 3 is available now for download on both desktop and mobile platforms. Beersmith 3 adds mead, wine, and cider support, new Whirlpool hop options, support for high-altitude beer brewing, and a whole lot more. Check out Beersmith 3 and get your free 21-day trial today from beersmith.com. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.